Hello and welcome to this miracle podcast from Serpentine Galleries, part of a series of audio explorations on the subject of miracles, including audio dramas, live musical performances, poetry and discussions. All of the material in this series was originally recorded at or produced for the Serpentine's Miracle Marathon Festival 2016. I'm Tabitha Thorley-Bangora, and with me is Lucia Pietrusti, Public Programmes Curator at the Serpentine.
Hi, Tabitha.
Hi, Lucia. Today's miracle is a conversation featuring Professor John Dylan Haynes, Chris DeMayer, and Arathi Prasad, moderated by Dr. Daniel Glazer. Lucia, maybe you could tell us a bit more about the panellists.
Yes, a very interesting group of panellists indeed. John Dylan Haynes' research focuses on the brain mechanisms that underlie human cognitive processes, and his special interests are in the ethical foundations of mental state decoding and in the neuroscience of consciousness, of intentions and of free will. Chris DeMayer, on the other hand, is a neuroscientist and a visiting research fellow at King's College in London. And he's particularly interested in using neuroscience to make sense of what goes on in society. The third panellist, Arathi Prasad, has worked in research, science policy and communication, but she has also presented several documentaries on science for the BBC, Channel 4, National Geographic and Discovery Channel. And she also works at University College in London.
So our moderator, Dr. Daniel Glazer, is a neuroscientist who has worked for many years promoting public engagement with science. He is director of Science Gallery London at King's College. This conversation about the scientific miracle was recorded on October 9th at Second Home in East London during the Serpentine's Miracle Marathon.
I'm delighted to start the next phase. My name is Daniel Glazer. I feel the need to do something very slightly transgressive, also just to break the trance-like mode that's immediately preceded. And so I'd be very grateful if you would turn to the person next to you and say in full voice, as if you were, you know, I don't know, on a crowded train where everyone else was shouting loudly, turn to the person next to you and say, I believe in miracles. Say it loudly. Say it now. Good. Well, we believe in miracles up here, and we believe in a particular kind of miracle, my friends, and that is the scientific miracle. And so for the next 25 minutes, the four of us here are going to have a little conversation about those. To my left, I have Arathi Prasad. Next to her is Chris DeMayer. And at the end is John Dylan Haynes. And each of them, in their own way, has got a perspective on scientific miracles, which I think you'll be eager to hear about. Firstly, it's a delight to be here in Second Home, and it's particularly enjoyable to see all the lovely folk from Serpentine Gallery slumming it out east and looking very slightly uncomfortable as they look outside and wonder how they're going to get back home. But all will be well, my friends. We'll be through by 1 a.m, and I'm sure Brick Lane will offer its pleasures to you. At that point. Now, Arathi, you wrote a book, you wrote a couple, but the first one I'm interested in, I'm going to hold up for you now. It's titled after the famous Madonna song, Like a Virgin. And it concerns a topic which I think has had miraculous resonance for many years now, which is the topic of virgin births. And I wonder, just to kick us off, can you tell us why you were interested in virgin births as a question or a topic or a thing?
I guess I like to twist ideas or status quos, and I was interested in this idea of parthenogenesis. It's from the Greek, like the Parthenon, the virgin.
Parthenogenesis. Okay,
yeah,
so
generation, the genesis of another being by through a virgin.
And what does parth mean?
Parthenogenesis.
Virgin. Yeah. Okay, cool. Parthenogenesis is virgin birth in Greek.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
And so I knew that because I studied biology, and I was a fan of developmental biology, that there was many, many animals. So nature was very normal, almost, but we couldn't do it. And so I remember saying to a friend, a great friend who's a developmental biologist and a mentor of mine, but he was quite discouraging. He said, why do you want to write about virgin birth? Humans can't do it. And I said, but that's why I'm interested. Why can almost all of nature do it and we can't? What was preventing us?
So just to be clear on that first point, if you take of nature in the whole, most of nature can do virgin births in that sense.
Yeah, so almost every type of animal except mammals. So it wasn't until 1984 that some scientists did experiments using mouse eggs and sperm where they put, you try to use, if you need two sets of DNA to make a new animal, mammal, why can't you use two eggs? Or why can't you use two sperms? And they did that experiment and they found out the mechanisms that prevented humans and all mammals.
So the answer to that is you can't.
Mammals can't.
Okay, so you can't, never mind virginity, we'll come back to it in a sec, but with two eggs you can't make another mammal, and with two sperm of mammals you can't
That's
make another
right.
mammal.
Can't.
Okay, did not know that already. Okay. Just out of interest, from a biologist's point of view, is there a kind of sensible definition of virginity?
The definition of virgin birth would be where no sperm, no father was involved in the creation of the offspring.
Okay, so would IVF be an example of a non-virgin birth?
Technically, it's not a virgin birth because there's sperm involved, but there are lots of animals in nature. There's an animal who uses a procedure known as kleptogenesis, so klepto, like kleptomaniac. So what they do is they steal or borrow sperm from a related species. These are all female. Okay. They borrow some sperm from related species. The sperm kick-starts the egg into developing,
right.
And then they get rid of all the father's DNA. So they only ever pass on the female. So where there may be some involvement.
How do you steal? Give us an example of a species that does this first, of course, so we can have a picture in our mind.
I think it's called an Ambystoma salamander.
Okay, so we've got a salamander. How do you steal sperm?
Well, they I think technically they mate, but then they jettison all of the DNA from the male. So they're using it to tell the egg, you can start dividing now, but they never incorporate any of it. So that is also a type of virgin birth.
So even though they're not virgins because there's sperm in the area, the thing that develops doesn't have any of its DNA in it?
No, a virgin birth doesn't have to be a child born of a virgin, but a birth where no male was involved.
Okay. And what do you, I mean, so clearly you got the book deal and it sold very well. My friends, there are still a few copies available in good bookshops, hopefully even across the road, but it sold well. Why do you think it's a fascinating question? What's interesting, do you think, culturally about the concept of virgin births as such?
Well, that's what's so interesting, because it wasn't until 1984 that we knew a mechanism as to why humans couldn't. Mm-hmm. All through human history, I think almost every culture has had some story of a virgin birth. From Christianity preceding it in Hindu scriptures in ancient Egypt, Babylon.
What's the Hindu version? What's the Hindu virgin birth story?
Well, there are many, but mm-hmm. for example, there was a queen called Kunti in the Mahabharata, and she had a mantra, a magic set of words that was given to her in case she wanted to have a child. And so one day when she was quite young and unmarried, she decided to try it out. And lo and behold, the Surya, the sun god, appeared to her, and she became pregnant. And then she had to give the child away. So the rest of the epic is involved with when she met her son again and when he came back. But she had to marry again and get rid of the child. And yeah. You could step on a leaf, you could stand in a shaft of light, you can eat a pomegranate. I mean, there's so many ways in which a woman could become pregnant. I guess biologically we just didn't really understand. I mean, I was reading that until people started domesticating dogs, say, or animals, there were the statues that they found represented female goddesses and not male gods. And the idea of how does a fully formed human being come out of a woman's body? The time when you had sex may not necessarily, well, you know, it's months until a woman actually shows. It's a miracle. It's a thing of wonder.
Of course, I mean, as a bloke and even as a father, I suppose, the notion that biological progress could bring about a time where my involvement in the fathering, as it were, of children is no longer required, I find somewhat unsettling. Did you, when you were researching this, come across this sense of male insecurity as part of what's going on in the story?
Well, in the second part of the book, I look at technologies and what the future might hold, and that includes things like an artificial womb. And with an artificial womb, that would give men the capability of having a child. And if you look at using, say, stem cells, and stem cells are cells you have in the body that can regenerate any other organ in your body. If you take them from a female, you can create eggs from them. That's not a surprise. But if you take them from a male, you can not only create sperm, but you can also create eggs from male.
Wait, so it's you guys that are not...
That's right, yes. Aristotle may have been right when he said women are defective and males are complete in that way. I think men have probably less to worry about than
that's
females.
That's deeply reassuring as a conclusion of the version. No, the book you wrote after that has recently come out. It's called In the Bone Setter's Waiting Room, and that's about medicine in India. And I guess the link for me about this is the kind of prevalence of these beliefs, which, at least from a perspective of a kind of rationalist, Western, neuroscientifically trained man on the street, seem ridiculous. And I just wonder if you can talk to us about how, in medicine at least, perhaps in India or otherwise, these different sets of belief can coexist simultaneously. It seems somewhat weird, although in fact it's true, I guess, in our society too.
I think in both cases there's a larger question of what does evidence mean and do we really need it as human beings anyway in order to use technology or use the world or get to the place we want to achieve our goals. For example, in the Virgin Births book, I was writing a bit about solo parents, and they're women who decide to have children later in life as opposed to single parents. They have plenty of money, and then they don't have a partner. But one of the women who did this use the technology because of her Christian beliefs, and she was single, so she wasn't allowed to have sex because it would be outside of marriage, so she chose to have IVF. And so in India it's the same. It's almost like I went to a hospital where there was a shrine outside, and the shrine was headed by an oracle, a woman with dreadlocks down to her legs, and people come and offer her chickens or goats to be slaughtered, so that the entrance to the hospital becomes a bloodbath once a year. And she helps women with problems. So there's a lot of gender violence. It's in the Slumdog Millionaire slum in Mumbai. It's the second biggest slum in the world, the biggest in Asia. And so, you know, there are a lot of traumatized people. And they come along and they tell her their problems and offer this animal. And then they walk into the hospital and go see a psychiatrist. And it's almost like, well, I don't know which one will work or why it would work. I don't read the scientific journals, and I don't know what the evidence is for the drugs that psychiatrists are giving me. Maybe most psychiatrists don't know the evidence either. It's not an obstacle. I'll try both.
So it's interesting. I suppose placebo effect, as we know, is the best validated effect in medicine. The more you believe in something, the more effective it is. And I guess to that extent, a miracle, an extraordinarily extreme belief, would be even more effective than a belief that was just kind of regularly weird. And people do sustain, don't they, Chris, these most extraordinary beliefs that, you know, so strongly held that all apparent evidence to the contrary fails to dissuade them of it. You've made a study in various contexts of these kinds of what we would call perhaps delusions, but what I think you'd like to call strongly held beliefs. How do you think people manage to sustain such things in the face of what the rest of us might think of as overwhelming evidence to the contrary?
Well, that's a very deep question with a lot of different facets to it. And so the first part is basically there's a push and pull between wanting to feel right about your beliefs and the pulling of the horror of actually being wrong in your beliefs. And that drives us, that has a tendency of driving us towards certainty. And so one of the ways that I got involved in this is that because I was flabbergasted by how many strong convictions there were out there and how people in society are opposing each other over these strong convictions, I decided to, together with a colleague, Sheila Marshall, who's a filmmaker, to make a film about a group of people who are absolutely convinced of something, but for whom we suspect that on a certain day they're going to be absolutely wrong and they're going to have to face that.
Reveal. who are these people and what do they believe?
So this is a group of people who set a date for the end of the world. And of course, they have that date there, and we were going to be there on that date with them and see what was going to happen.
What was the date, Chris?
It was the 21st of May of 2011.
So few, looks like they were wrong.
Yes, we're still here.
Yeah.
The film, by the way, is just recently finished. It's called Right Between Your Ears. And
Right Between Your Ears?
Yes.
With an R-I-G-H-T.
Yes.
Nice.
And does follow them throughout that whole period, because we sort of thought, based on what we knew from the literature in psychology and neuroscience, where these kind of things have been studied since the 50s at least and even before, that they would go through a certain emotional roller coaster when it doesn't happen.
So you were most interested, so I mean, you come from a neuroscientific background, but the as it were, the money shot for you was, is it midnight at the beginning of the day, or were they kind of thinking, well, hey, could still happen any time up to midnight at the end of the day, right? But you were interested in what would happen when their belief was shown to be wrong by the fact that the world was still there.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What happened?
So so they go into a state of cognitive dissonance, which psychologists call cognitive dissonance. And a lot of us have heard about cognitive dissonance, which usually we used to talk about other people saying, you're inconsistent, you're feeling cognitive
dissonance.
You believe
that we can maintain free movement of people and...
Yes, exactly. So a lot of us waking up on the 24th actually felt cognitive dissonance about how the way the vault had gone.
Least of what we thought.
It's not that different from waking up on the 22nd of May and finding out that the world hasn't ended. But so they're entering this state, and because their conviction was so strong, and the disconfirmation of it was so clear, according to their own belief systems, not because someone else had managed to convince them, their state of cognitive dissonance is very deep, and it takes them several days of really deep emotional discomfort that they're going through before they start pulling out.
Did they kind of carry on eating and stuff? I mean, were they able to function? Probably kept breathing, but I mean, were they frozen in some sense, or how did they handle the discomfort?
I don't know whether they were eating in the days after, but it does feel that the turmoil is all internal, and it feels inside. So they didn't start rolling over the floor and crying when it didn't happen. That's not how it works. Mm-hmm. The closest that maybe you can think about it is when you're watching your favorite football team, like England or any national team, and you're 10 minutes in and you're 1-0 behind, and you still have these 80 minutes that can rectify the situation. And so you're there, and the further you get, the more this feeling of dread starts setting in. And so it's that feeling that is the counterpart to the normal feeling that we're in, that feeling where everything that we believe sort of fits together and feels right, that is the thing that is so abhorrent that we want to stay away from it.
Arati, did you want to come in on that? Because it's kind of the opposite of the kinds of belief, I guess, that you were looking at in the medical systems that you were studying.
In the medical systems, but as when I was writing the Like a Virgin, I interviewed a professor at University College where I work, who's a very senior member of staff, he's a developmental biologist, but he's also a very staunch Christian. And, you know, the idea of virgin birth, so this was in 2012 I wrote the book, so I said 1984, we knew that mammals couldn't have virgin births, and we knew that if they did, the child would always be female, right? So a lot of females in nature, when they give birth, it's only to females. So he had to square in his mind why Mary didn't give birth to a daughter, and also what possible biological mechanisms they could have been for Mary to have Jesus as a. And he spent a long time thinking through several what he called biologically implausible possibilities to square in his mind how he could believe in the virgin birth and still be a professor of biology.
And the effort to kind of rationalize repeatedly is something I guess you must have observed in the people that you were studying, if I can say studying as a filmmaker.
That we were with, let's say it like that. Yes, absolutely. So the rationalization was going on before the date happens, before it doesn't happen, so to speak, because that's what has driven them to certainty. It's when we are relatively uncertain about something and we do something, that doing, the choice that we make, changes our beliefs. So common sense would dictate us that we're always doing the things that we believe in, but it doesn't always work like that. In situations where at some point in time we're not that certain about a choice that we make, it's the choice that we make and the actions that we do as a consequence that make us more certain of that.
So we reinforce our sense of ourselves. John, you're a neuroscientist, a cognitive neuroscience even these days, and you've studied, I think, in the lab, you know, like measuring brains, situations where people have beliefs about what's going on inside their own heads that are mistaken. Maybe you could just quickly sketch out for us an example of such a situation, and then maybe help us to understand from a neuroscientific point of view what might be going on inside the heads of the people that Chris was filming. But give us a specific lab-based experiment, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, so we, my day job is to put people in brain scanners, measure their brain activity while they're thinking. And one of the experiments we did a couple of years ago was to see or compare people's beliefs about how they make decisions with what the brain is actually doing. And what you can see is that a lot of our beliefs about the way we function are wrong. So, for example, if you ask people, give them the choice to spontaneously lift the left or right hand, they
so
will...
It's lying in the scanner. They can choose to lift whichever hand they want.
Or just do it with the audience here. People will have the impression that there's nothing constraining them. There's no constraint. There's nothing making them take the left or the right hand. They will feel free. In a funny way, it feels as if in that kind of a situation, you can free yourself from the laws of the universe. You think the mind makes up its mind on its own, independent of the body, independent of the brain, and then something interferes with your brain, makes you put your action in, put it into action.
So
basically, you lift your hand. Yeah. So we think that there's a secret little mind space where we can make our decisions, and then we kind of, if we don't put them into action, nobody would ever know about it.
Okay, so what you're describing is the model that most of us would have about the situation where we can just choose to lift a hand anytime we want.
Exactly, that's what most people would think.
Yes.
If you look into people's brains, what you find is that even with these free decisions, brain activity preceding these free decisions gives away which choice they're going to make. So at a point in time when you think you're still free to choose between the left or right hand, it seems as if your brain has already made up its mind, and this freedom that you experience at the point of decision is just an illusion.
And can you tell, as an experimenter, what people are going to choose before they can?
Exactly. So the point of the experiment is that you get them to make a choice, and you ask them when they made their choice, and then you look back in the brain activity preceding the choice. And what you see several seconds before they make up their mind, you can already predict to some degree which choice they're going to make.
Several seconds?
Yeah, several seconds. Now, I have to say, these are not decisions about driving a car and someone kind of swerving in your way, and okay, you have to make a quick
something
reaction.
Something can arise. Yes.
It's a different kind of decision. It's a decision where you you can pace the decision, you can time it as you want. Mm-hmm. But it's still, there's quite a discrepancy here between the way you think you make up your mind and these unconscious brain processes preparing your decision.
Now, when you hear that story, Chris, do you think, as a neuroscientist, but then as someone who's spent time with people with, you know, what we would call delusional beliefs, things which, you know, which they believe, which the rest of us think are, I mean, again, I'm trying to choose my words carefully, but many of us would consider them crazy or certainly very different from what we think. Do you think that there are neuroscientific mechanisms at play that allow us to sustain these very dissonant beliefs?
Yes, absolutely. There's actually two sides to the question you just asked, and the one is sits in the judgment that we're making about their beliefs. And one of the things that I was sort of conscious of before starting on the film, but definitely since starting on the film and then talking to lots of people about it, is that everyone has beliefs about why other people have beliefs. We all have a belief about why that person believes that thing. And usually we're a lot less positive about that. It's like, I believe my things because I'm sensible and rational, but that person believes because he's deluded or crazy.
Okay, so the account we have of our own beliefs is more positive and perhaps rational than the accounts that we have of other people's beliefs.
Yes. Yeah. So, but similar to the experiment that John described, we repeated an experiment for the film where we took one of those believers and we let him undergo a brain scanning experiment to see what belief looks like inside the brain. And that was a repetition of an experiment that had happened in 2008 and 2009, and that had been conducted with groups of atheists and Christians, and had asked them questions about their beliefs, their for instance, God is a myth or God is real, is a question that these two different groups answer in a different way. Well, when they're in the scanner and you look at the signal that comes out of it, there's no difference at the group's level. So when we call someone delusional, that judgment sits in our brain. It's not to be found in the brain of the other person.
So that's to say, from a neuroscientific point of view, there's no marker of somebody who has a delusional belief from the perspective of everyone else in society. From the inside, it feels the same as the belief that, I don't know, -1 is a negative number, or you know, that this floor is hard.
Yes, with the possible exception of in psychiatry, the term delusional beliefs has a very well-described meaning. It's not used to describe any belief that's wrong or crazy. It's linked to very specific delusional states, like Capgras delusion, where you think that all the people around you have been replaced by aliens or robots, for instance.
And that was something that occurred to many of us on the 24th of May, but yeah. John?
I'd like to strengthen this point. I think it's really important that there is no distinction in the brain between truth and fiction. The brain has its own way of thinking about things, and it doesn't know if that's correct or if it's incorrect. Mm-hmm. Nice examples, you can find them also in memory research. So if you compare false memories to real memories, the brain signals them with the memory brain areas, the hippocampus, as memories. It doesn't make a distinction between correct and incorrect memories. If you remember the sniper attack in, I think it was Sarajevo on Hillary Clinton, where she, there's video evidence that there was no sniper attack on her plane, but she claimed that there was a sniper attack. There was a big debate in the memory literature years later when it came out that presumably she didn't know the difference. She thought that it really happened. Perhaps she went through this belief for many times and she started, her memory started playing tricks on her. And in the end, she did believe the story she was telling. So the brain doesn't
know the
difference.
Something you could probably never accuse Donald Trump of, but yes.
Yeah. No, absolutely not.
In one of the stories I found from the 1950s, a scientist at UCL had, had done a study on guppies and found that they could have births without males. She separated them in a tank and the female.
Guppies, the kind of little
The fish, and they carried on having babies. And so she gave a talk at UCL and a journalist was there. And in the talk, someone asked, can this happen in humans as well? And she said, maybe, but it'll be very rare because it would be in either women's prisons or hospitals. And the journalist went away and, cut a long story short, it became the front page of the tabloid, and it initiated a call for women to come forward if they thought they had had a virgin birth. And they were subjected to a range of tests by the Medical Research Council, and serious doctors, best tests of the day. And one woman couldn't be disproven. Now, she was a woman who came from Hanover, and then, this was during the Second World War, married a Welsh soldier. And she was in a hospital at the time that she became pregnant. One of the things they considered was she couldn't possibly have had a virgin birth. None of the tests could disprove it, but they didn't have DNA tests then. But what would make a woman come forward knowing that she'd been subjected to a battery of medical tests and it's become public and her daughter was in the paper? She had to really, really, really believe that was possible. And when you were speaking, I was wondering about culture in ideas, because no one is delusional. Everyone, according to the brain, everyone is right. And that must change whether you come from, if you come from somewhere in India and you believe that it's a woman's fault when she has a daughter, or someone in the West who comes from a different
mindset. I'm going to ask each of you as we wrap up, Chris, what do you think is the value of miracles, of these, what we might call delusion beliefs in culture? Do they have a value? What is the use of them from your observations?
Well, evolutionary speaking, they do have a value of binding groups of people together. Now, in this present culture that we live in, that becomes a little bit defective because we are exposed to so many different groups and we are part of so many different groups. So that is leading to clashes, and we have to sort of find new ways to step over what we've been endowed with, evolutionary speaking.
John, do you see a value to these beliefs which can be easily disproved?
I think what they do is they give us a shorthand description for something we don't understand, and that at least we have the impression we understand something by saying it's by the power of God or something that the lightning struck. Whereas in fact, we just don't understand lightning. Perhaps 200 years ago, we didn't. So it's just a shorthand explanation for understood facts.
And do they play a big role, Arati, in your studies of medicine?
Yeah, I think we're always looking for answers, but sometimes we don't need to know how something works, but only that it does.
Very good. Well, my friends, this has been a brief and miraculous tour of scientific miracles, and I hope you'll join me, Daniel Glazer, in thanking our speakers, Arati Prasad, Christa Meyer, and John Dylan Haynes. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for listening to this Miracle Podcast. For more Serpentine Radio podcasts, please visit radio.serpentinegalleries.org.
I'm just trying to figure out.